Great to have you along on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Larry Mueller here. We're talking about great gardens and great gardeners of the past and the present next, and what they can teach us about planting our own gardens. Larry Mueller here, and my guest today, Matthew Biggs, is author of Lessons from the Great Gardeners, 40 Gardening Icons and What They Teach Us. He trained at the Royal Botanic Gardens in the UK. He's a member of the Woody Plant Committee of the Royal Horticultural Society, also a panel member on BBC Radio's Radio 4's Gardeners Question Time. And he joins us from England. And I'm hoping you'll join in as well. What would you like to ask him about the great gardens or gardeners he's encountered and what they can teach us? Join in the conversation at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. We'd love to hear from you. And Matthew Biggs, thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Oh, it's an absolute pleasure.
Oh, I tell you what, a few years ago, I was fortunate enough with many Wisconsin Public Radio listeners to have a garden tour of England. We went to the Hampton Flower Show and then Great Dexter and Sissinghurst and many of the private gardens that normally aren't open. And it was just a marvelous time. So it was fun to see some of the gardens that we saw sort of highlighted in ways in your book.
Yes, I think so. There's a very British influence in gardens throughout the world. I mean, we started our gardening, and you mentioned early on this great point that it started out as cottage gardens, and people were actually just gardening to feed the family to feed their stock. And then little by little, the idea came to bring flowers into gardens. The idea we have of the cottage garden, of the mixtures of flowers and vegetables together, and the flowers for the bees, and the flowers for everybody to enjoy. And little by little, it sort of stepped away, and as people became more prosperous and life changed, into the style of ornamental gardening that is so dominant in Britain, and it has actually spread throughout the world. And I think it's lovely that we can all develop our own styles. You know, the Italians develop their style, the Americans have their styles. There are influences of climate depending on where you're actually gardening, so you react to what's there. So it allows people, I think, to express themselves in their garden and with their plants.
But what a challenge for you to seek out and compile the stories of the great gardeners of our time. I wondered, well, what prompted him to do this?
Well, Larry, you're absolutely right. The challenge was massive. And when the idea first came up, I was thinking, however do you select from all the great gardeners through time and space, how do you nail them down and actually get the ones that you need? And so what I decided in the end is that we were limited to 40, was to look at the different gardening styles and to make sure that there was Japanese gardens in there, Italian ape gardens, there were plants people's gardens, cottage gardens, new perennial gardens. And so I went through all the sections first to try and find who were the greatest exponents of these styles, past and present.
And then from there, the massive job of whittling it down, that must have been a real challenge.
It was a huge challenge. I mean, the first thing was, once we'd whittled it down to the numbers, the idea was then to try and not just talk about the style in which they garden, but also to discover their personalities. Because you have to, it's like you go and see a gardener and you go, oh, that's wonderful. I wonder who made this. I wonder what they're like. I wonder what their motivation is, and, you know, what is their passion. And as you sort of read through the book, I really hope that you can gather that the majority of these people were obsessive in a way, in the way that they gardened, and it was just a way of life. But you have to meet the people, I think, to realize why the garden is like it is.
And it's really interesting. I was fascinated by the stories behind these people and what led them to where they, to their successes. It really fascinating. Many of them, I know, were very wealthy.
That is one of the criteria that shines out, doesn't it, Larry? People who could indulge in the art of gardening, they had the money, they had the space. They often lived in castles or manor houses or where time and money just didn't matter. And I think so often when you look at the great gardeners, they became great gardeners. One was because they were able to garden themselves all of the time or much of the time. A lot of them actually also had extremely good head gardeners. Who helped them realise their dreams. I think the head gardeners don't get enough recognition, and the staff who worked for them who were equally skilled. But I think with these great gardeners themselves, they often sat and thought about gardening as well as doing it, or while they gardened, they probably thought. And to be a great gardener, you have to be an experimenter with plants or with ideas and push boundaries. And I think that was one thing that I really discovered myself when I was writing the book, was that these people questioned and queried and didn't take received wisdom as being the only way.
And they not all were wealthy to start out. Jeff Hamilton, for example. I don't think he came from a necessarily wealthy family.
No, he didn't. Jeff Hamilton was one of the great practical British TV gardeners who was on the BBC flagship gardening program, Gardeners World, for many, many years. And he came from a very ordinary background. He started gardening when he was 14. His mother wanted him to be an accountant. His father didn't mind, so he did what he wanted. And he started off in horticulture, was very good at college. He achieved a very high level of education and just had an affinity and an instinct that meant he understood gardening. And with Jeff, funnily enough, as soon as you say Jeff Hamilton, I always think of the little story that he decided to buy a plant centre when he left college, and he bought it, but obviously didn't have a vast amount of money to employ staff to restore it. And he worked so hard on it that he wore his fingerprints off.
That was an amazing story.
And that's just that. And I spoke to his son. His son Nick still gardens at the same garden, and there is the legacy there of these model gardens that Jeff made, and they used to film on the television. And so I got some lovely little stories from Nick about Jeff, and the whole idea was to try and find out about what these people were really like, what made them tick, and any of the little quirks that they had, or things that you and I might look at and think, oh, do you know what, I do exactly the same.
It was very interesting. I love the background stories on them, and then I also the lessons. You have something called or a section for many of the people called Lessons from the Greats, which I thought was some great tips.
Yes, that was quite difficult in a way, because when I researched, I wanted to. I mean, the reason for getting people who knew them was to get the stories that I knew weren't in print. So if I phoned up somebody who Christopher Lloyd's head gardener down at Great Dixter, Fergus. Mm. Fergus Garrett now looks after the garden there. But I was able to, through a telephone conversation, rather than anything that's scripted or on the internet, was say to him, do you know what's he really like, and what kind of tips and ideas can we get from them? So some of them were actually tips that Christopher Lloyd and the others regularly passed on. Others were just by observing and looking, and with my horticultural background, sort of deducing from what I saw. So it was a mixture of the two. When I came to the end of it, I actually felt quite happy. I thought, you know, that combination of the two will be great for anybody who wants to read the book, because they'll feel that they're getting little snippets of information from these great people, either through observation or direct quote. These great people who, you know, you never, in many cases, had a chance to meet.
Yeah, and in your book, you talk about gardens reflecting the personality and character of the creator of the creators of the gardens.
Yes, it's really interesting. I think it reflects a lot about a person's life. I mean, I work for myself. I have a family of teenagers. I spend a lot of time on work rather than the garden, where I'd love to have the money just to garden all the time.
Yeah.
But, wouldn't we all?
Yeah.
And I think my garden reflects where my interest lies. There's a lot of species plants. It's not particularly an artistic place. It's a collection of characterful and unusual plants with stories, because I love the stories. So I think if you're naturally artistic, you know, it expresses your situation. So I think the controls for it is, one is, as usual, how much money you have, how much time you have, and how many distractions there are, and how much space you have. And then I think people will then plant accordingly. I popped into London this morning, Larry, and I passed a little flat, a little apartment, and there were two small gardens. One was full of brightly coloured tulips and the daffodils that are now in flower.
Yeah.
Another one was similar, with some topiary hedgerow in there, all neatly clipped and tidy. And between those two was just a small area where obviously the elderly lady or gentleman had filled it full of some plastic ornaments, and it was, to my eyes, slightly bizarre. But one thing I've realised is that with your space, the really important thing for anyone who gardens is that it's an expression of themselves and their character. And if it makes them happy, it doesn't matter whether it's full of plastic gnomes or whether it's tulips and daffodils. The answer is that if it gives you joy, and hopefully other people gain pleasure from it, then it's right. So I think the lovely thing about gardening, there isn't a right or wrong. It's what you feel and what you can do.
Matthew Biggs, our guest today, having a lot of fun talking with him. He is the author of several books, including the one we're visiting about today. It's titled Lessons from the Great Gardeners, 40 Gardening Icons and What They Teach Us. I hope you'll join in with your own questions, comments, or experiences to share. Give a call at 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org. Or go ahead and post on our Facebook page. Our Facebook page title, The Larry Mueller Show. I'm Larry Mueller. Jill Nadeau, our on-air producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network as we visit now with Matthew Biggs, author of Lessons from the Great Gardeners, 40 Gardening Icons and What They Teach Us. I hope you'll join in with your own questions or comments at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Love to hear from you. I know you sought out, there were some fantastic people you have in this book. Gertrude Jekyll is one that comes to mind to me. What a productive life that woman led.
Yeah, she did, didn't she? I mean, she was the most extraordinary lady. Around about the time she was trained as an artist and then moved into gardening. And around about that time, there was a movement in English gardens to move away from the rigid formality that had gone before in Victorian times, where plants were formally planted out in rows, formal bedding schemes. And William Robinson, who was another of the great gardeners, and he was a great writer. And that's another thing as well, by the way, Larry. Something else that I noticed was, in those days, obviously people hadn't got radio and television, but they became great gardeners by actually distributing and dispersing their ideas in journals and in books, and that's part of their greatness as well. And Gertrude Jekyll followed or went along with that idea. He talked about, let's break up these rigid straight lines of tender plants that are forced in greenhouses and put out into gardens in straight lines, and let's go to nature and see how they express themselves. So William Robinson said, let's look at nature and see how nature plants her own woodlands and fields. And then Gertrude Jekyll, who became friendly with him because she had similar ideas, and she said, well, let's take the idea of the colour wheel and use the colours of the colour wheel in the garden in textures, shapes and forms. So these sort of principles of harmony in the composition of colours is actually in her gardens. And she was influenced by the Impressionists as well, by William Turner. She copied his paintings, and it was his idea of light and colour that she then brought out into the garden and actually wrote it down in a book called Colour in the Flower Garden in 1908. So she again wrote down her ideas. But she was an extraordinary lady, because she also was good at carving and carpentry and gilding and thatching and walling, as well as her garden. And I suppose she was an arts and crafts gardener before the whole idea came to the fore.
Yeah, but to design more than 400 gardens.
Yeah, that's extraordinary. And she had some... Well, one of the things that made Gertrude Jekyll great was the collaborations that she had with others, notably Edward Lutyens. So Edward Lutyens, as an architect and builder, had these phenomenal ideas. And he would do the hard landscaping, the paths and the pergolas and the beautiful walls, all done in beautifully crafted style. And then she would actually impose her plantings upon those. So between the two of them, she was brilliant at her job. He was brilliant at his. And it was one of those partnerships that couldn't fail.
Oh, absolutely. It just a wonderful story with her. And, you know, you're talking color, which reminded me of the Sissinghurst of gardens, especially the White Garden, and of Vita Sackville West, I believe.
Yes. Vita Sackville West, again, was a very interesting lady with her garden. And, yes, her White Garden was very, very, or is very, very famous. Because it's when you're planting white, I mean, you have to be very careful when you copy these ideas, because on a practical level, a lot of plants that are white don't always die very well. So they die and become brown.
Ah.
And so consequently, they become an eyesore instead of something which is really beautiful to look at. And she actually was able to overcome this by choosing the right plants. But of course, they look, when you're planting a white garden, they look particularly beautiful at dawn and even more so at twilight or on a moonlit night, where you've got the full moon and the dark sky shining onto this white garden. So they become very, very romantic and very beautiful, and you just see the ghostly shapes of the structures. And she actually wanted it to be... she described it as a white and green garden. Obviously, we've adopted the idea of it being white, but she thought of the other colours and first wrote about this idea in the Observer newspaper.
Having seen that garden, the White Garden, the whole garden's there in July, probably around the 2nd of July a few years back, things were just full bloom, and it was just a... unbelievable sight. It was just beautiful garden.
It is glorious, isn't it? I mean, it's a very brave thing, I think, to take one colour, particularly when the colour is white. Larry, when you saw it, what did you think? You'd obviously read about it and heard about it. What did you think about it all when you saw it?
I was just so taken. It was lovely. You think about just one colour, and especially white, not being very pretty if it was all white. But in this case, it was just stunning.
Yes, it is a most extraordinary place. And I think just for the sheer bravery of it all, because I think we often think, let's go for the use of colour, because that helps, when the plants will complement or contrast. And she did everything with such sort of beautiful artistic style. And I think really with hers, this idea of her grey, green and white garden, which she had, I think it was really brave of her to even have a go at white. And it is just a remarkable place. And if I would say to any of your listeners, if they ever come over to Britain, there are fabulous gardens, but I think one thing that you must see is this white garden and see where this whole idea began.
And it's and the property itself was just a rundown piece of property.
Yes, I mean the estate agent's description was just a farmhouse with some picturesque ruins in the grounds. And she actually, when she saw it, she said, I fell in love, love at first sight, when I saw what might be made of it. Well, what a vision to be able to look at something that's described as a picturesque, a farmhouse with picturesque ruins, and then see the use of the space. And how she could develop it. But again, it wasn't, I mean, I have to say, and I don't want to detract from her because she was wonderful, but there were others who you see, her husband, he had the idea and worked on the structure and the garden rooms in there. So it was a combination of the two of them. Obviously, she painted with plants, but it took her diplomat husband, Harold Nicholson, to actually, you know, work out the framework where these plants could be best displayed.
And she had a great gardener too, if I'm not mistaken, who did a lot of work with the roses that she had.
Yeah, yes, she did. His name was Jack Vass.
That's it.
And Jack Vass had actually worked at a garden called Bord Hill. Bord Hill is a lovely garden in Sussex nearby, and there's wonderful roses, lots of rhododendrons and trees that were introduced by the great plant collectors. But it was Jack Vass who worked there as well, and also worked at another great English garden called Cliveden. And Jack Vass was instrumental in working out great ways of training roses, so that they looked absolutely beautiful. So he actually took hoops made of just hazel twigs, and he bent them over so that they were folded one over the other to look like lobster pots, and then you could actually use that and train the climbing roses around these bent shoots. So it's almost like an upturned wicker basket with the roses trained over it, which is used in lots of gardens. But what a great idea, because you just have this, yes, you have the walls closed with roses, and you have the moss roses and the old English roses leaning forward, but then you've got just another dimension of having them trained in, you know, hemispheres of flowers.
You know, you've organized, we've jumped around a little bit on the book, but you've organized it sort of by time period rather than by style of garden.
Yes, it was difficult to know how to do it, to be honest with you. So at the end of the day, I think the time period worked quite well, because you could then put sort of, you would then get an idea of what was happening in different parts of the world or where the major gardening was taking place, and the different ideas and styles. So it was very difficult to know how to best arrange it, but chronological order came to the fore and seemed to work. And I think the other thing is that you then can go, you can look at modern gardens and then see where their influence has been. So you can look at the new perennial movement with the, you know, the prairie style gardening. You can look at the cottage gardening, and you can go back to where it originated, and also look, you know, go way back to China and to Japan, and see gardening with a completely different either philosophy or religious influence. So it is very much an art form. It's a wonderful art form, and I think it's lovely because it means that anybody can, you know, you might not be able to sketch with a pencil or paint beautifully. You might not be able to paint like Monet or anything like that. But what you can do is you can buy some plants and arrange them in a system and in positions where it pleases you, and you can express yourself as an artist with plants. So that means that everybody has a little bit of art in their soul.
Looking at the influential gardeners of all time, you have many women. I wonder what's the ratio of women to men in the. And I didn't really count it up.
No, I haven't either, to be honest with you, Larry. But that's you're absolutely right. There's a lot of ladies in there, and that's something else that you realise that it doesn't matter. You know, it doesn't matter who you are, what you are, where you are. It's about having the passion and the talent and the desire. And I think so. It doesn't matter at all. You can garden. You know, even if there's somebody in a high rise block with just a little bit of space on the windowsill, then you can garden a few houseplants. Or if you have just a small backyard with a little bit of space in there, then you can grow some things in pots and make the pots colourful and make that your garden. And then as you go onwards, then, of course, you know, the gardens get larger and you can become more extravagant with your ideas. But one of the lovely things for me is that gardening is for everyone. Everybody can have, you know, one, two, three little pots, and that can be their garden. They could have some bonsai. That can be their garden. All inclusive, I think. That's the lovely thing about it. Even if you end up gardening on a windowsill inside the house, there is a plant yep. from all the different habitats of the world that will grow there.
Brenda emailed and wondered about, and she's asking a question here that's kind of goes along with what you've just been talking about. But what do you think is the best way to become a good gardener? Is formal education important?
One of the things is, yes, I think formal education is important, but it depends how you want to garden and how you want to develop yourself. Because if you look at all the great gardeners, or if you look at gardeners, that you can speak to somebody who's been through, 85 summers and has gardened through the majority of them, and they will have gained a considerable amount of experience. I think what education does is explains to you why a lot of these things happen. So it sort of it refines a lot of your ideas and your thoughts. And instead of doing something and then it works, you realize why it works. And I think that helps you bend the rules a little bit, if you like. So I think it gives you greater confidence if you've had an education. But again, that education can also come with age. So I think, I was really fortunate and studied at Kew, and so we had on tap all the experience of Kew and the gardeners. So it helped us to sort of refine our ideas, but also we gained a few miles, kilometres head start because we got the information straight away rather than having to learn it from our own from experience.
I'm thinking of some of the American gardeners you had and one, Thomas Jefferson, was quite the student.
Yes, you see, that was interesting because he was a meticulous keeper of records and a great experimenter, and it was to him. When you read his life or his gardening life story, you realize this was very much in the way that he approached his politics and everything else. He was a very extremely intelligent person. And so for him to approach it in a scientific way and to record and to experiment, for him to collect, he collected North American plants and realized the diversity and value of what you had growing at home. The other thing I think is that gardening will satisfy your personality, whatever it is. So if you're a scientist, you can look at it from the scientific side. If you're an artist, you can look at it from a particularly artistic side and how the colours and the textures and the forms work together. And if you don't have either of those, you can just use it to express the way you feel. Yeah. In fact, one of the great gardeners who really caught my imagination, because in a way she was sort of quite ordinary, was a lady called Ray Selling Berry. And she was actually living around Oregon. And she just started off with two pots outside the back door. She just thought, oh, it'd be quite nice to brighten up my house. So she just bought some pots of flowers, then realized she could garden. And she loved it. And then she just got more and more passionate about collecting unusual plants. And she had the most phenomenal collection of plants from China, from the Himalayas, from the Caucasus. And she tapped into the fact that the great British plant hunters like George Forrest and Frank Kingdon Ward, and the great American plant hunter Joseph Rock, who collected extensively in China, she she realised she could tap into all these collections, and she built up this phenomenal garden, which sounded absolutely extraordinary. And rather than just growing ones and twos of things, she was growing tens of things absolutely brilliantly, because she'd, you know, she'd got a green thumb, and that was it. But she sounded like an extraordinary lady. And I think what also I find interesting, she suffered, and she suffered from an illness whereby she gradually lost her hearing. But what gardening did was that it allowed her to communicate with others, so she could continue to express herself. And she wrote. She wrote a lot of letters and communicated with great plants people. And so it gave her an interest, and still maintains this this link with the outside world without this, despite this burden of her hereditary deafness.
Amazing woman. And, you know, Mildred Blandy was another amazing gardener.
Mildred Blandy has, I mean, she's gardening. The island of Madeira, where she gardens, the climate is absolutely wonderful. It's very temperate. It's very kind. They are slightly at altitude just outside the city of Funchal, the capital city of this little Atlantic island where you have this benign climate. And so what she did was she realized that you could gather plants from all over the world because of the climate. You could grow plants from, she was from South Africa, so she could grow South African plants, Australia, New Zealand, the bulbous plants. She could grow plants from all over the world, as well as traditional English garden plants, like, you know, like your roses, for example. Mm-hmm. And so she combined them together into this extraordinary garden. But it is an absolutely lovely place to go just for this. I've been fortunate enough to visit it several times, and you just, as soon as you step off the coach as a gardener, you go, oh my goodness, I would just love to garden here, because it's just so equable and so great, you know, for, you don't have harsh winters. You get plenty of rain, so things will grow, but you just get, it's almost like gardening in a plant propagator.
That's wonderful. You know, you call, back to an American for a minute, Dan Hinckley, you call him the consummate 21st century plantsman, and you consider him quite impactful.
Yes, I do. I mean, he's mainly because of his passion, his ability to communicate, but also the fact that he had an eye, or has an eye still, for a really good plant. He loves his plants. He knows his plants. And I think the great thing about people like him is that, you know, in his days of plant collecting, when he went out to Vietnam, wherever he traveled, because he was a nurseryman, he would be on the lookout for good plants. So you've got people like Dan Hinckley who have used their expertise and their passion and their knowledge to our benefit. So he goes out there, you know, collects all these fabulous plants, and then we go, oh, thank you ever so much for your skill in collecting. We'll plant them in our gardens. And it allows us to increase the palette of plants that we have within our gardens. So I think the work of the plant collectors, even though we tend to think of it as being something that happened in Victorian Europe, mm-hmm. actually is something that with somebody like Dan, and with his collecting with Sue and Blethyn Wynne Jones at Krug Farm Plants, wherever they've been collecting, they very generously have used their skill, as I say, and then collected for us. You know, they're running a nursery, that's absolutely fine, but, you know, at the end of the day, we can have some superb plants in our gardens, and our gardens can be, you know, full of novelties, new plants, new ideas, and we can experiment with plant hardiness too, because of the work of these people who are, you know, prepared to get covered in leeches and, you know, be, you know, covered in, you know, in water for 90% of the time through heavy rain and what have you, and have all these arduous conditions. They go out and do the hard graft, and we enjoy the plants.
And, but he does say it's our duty to kill as many plants as possible.
Yes, I mean, that's an interesting comment. When I first sort of, oh my goodness, but you know, that's true. It is this experimentation, because what you tend to, I mentioned earlier on about the great gardeners not only have this sort of instinct for the garden and the feel for the soil and the plants and just their environment, but also they're prepared to push boundaries. And the thing is, when you bring a plant back from, you know, Mexico or wherever you've been collecting, or Vietnam, or Guatemala, Japan, when you've actually been there, you're bringing back plants and nobody's ever grown them before. And I think that's the thing. The key thing is to have the courage to propagate these plants and try them in. Okay, you knew where you found it, but it may be that the plants are tolerant of other conditions. One of the gardeners in there is a chap called Will Giles. And Will Giles actually came over and lectured in America several times, because he was gardening in a tropical style in a temperate climate. And so he was actually gardening with some hardy exotics and also with those that were slightly tender. Now, what he did was, I remember him once saying to me, he said, well, when I look at a lot of the plants that I'm growing, he said, the reference relates to Victorian gardening and keeping them in glass houses. And he said, and I can't afford to keep my glass house, my polythene tunnels heated to the levels that they do. So he experimented with hardiness, and some of his plants died, so he bought them again. And then he knew that, okay, to overwinter them, they need the atmosphere to be drier, or in fact, they need the temperature to be a minimum of 20 degrees C instead of 15. So I think this idea of killing plants, so you initially, there's a sharp intake of breath, and oh my goodness, you can't do that. You're supposed to be a gardener. But the answer is that, that by doing that, you do work out what your parameters are for everybody else and for the future. So it's not it might sound a bit harsh, but it's not quite as alarming as it initially appears.
Oh, Matthew, this is such a wonderful time talking with you. How do you see your book impacting gardeners around the world?
I would like gardeners to read it and think, do you know what, I can do this. And I think that's the one thing that you get from all of the gardeners here, that they've tried things, that they've gardened in many, many different styles. And I'm hoping that as people read through, they'll see the characters of the individuals, they'll see the passion, they'll see the obsession, and then they'll go, do you know what? I want some of this.
Thank you so much for taking time. I hope I can. I'm hoping I can do another garden tour of England. And when I do, I'll be getting a hold of you, and hopefully we can meet at that time.
Larry, please do. I'd love to meet up with you. And I wish all your listeners, I hope they have a wonderful gardening season, have a fabulous gardening year, and happy gardening to everyone.
Matthew Biggs, our guest today. Wasn't that fun? Great fun talking with him. He is the author of actually several books, but the one we talked about today is titled Lessons from the Great Gardeners, 40 Gardening Icons and What They Can Teach Us. And, you know, he has so much enthusiasm. Isn't that wonderful to hear that? And his enthusiasm, I think, comes through in his writing. And in the stories that he tells about the gardeners that the 40 great gardeners that he talks about, men and women who have done a marvelous job over the years. Well, coming up, we're gonna switch gears. We're gonna talk with another author, but about a totally different kind of story. This one has to do with an animal that is pretty cool. It's a salamander. And there's a children's book out that explores the wonders of salamanders and vernal ponds. It's called Salamander Dance. It is a lovely book, and you're going to hear some more about it coming up next on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.